Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 243, being recorded on August 6th of the year 2000. We're going to be taking a look at a number of different stories and updating a number of stories from the past in this next half hour. We're going to begin by taking a look at an article from the San Francisco Examiner of Monday, May 15th of the year 2000. Many listeners are aware of the fact that a suit against the United States government with regard to the Branch Davidian massacre, the Waco situation, was ultimately unsuccessful. There was a finding by the government and also a ruling in the lawsuit that basically the Branch Davidians themselves were responsible for setting a fire in that particular case. There's been a lot of disinformation about the Waco situation and a lot of propaganda about that by elements on the far right, the militia movement, the Patriots Network, and others. One wants to attempt to separate the wheat from the chaff with regard to the Branch Davidian situation, and that is not an easy thing to do. I would note that the arrest warrant for David Koresh was actually executed in the summer of 1992 when George Bush was president of the United States and when his Justice Department was still holding forth under William Barr, a quote ex-unquote CIA officer, just like George Bush. I would also note that even though Bill Clinton was president and had been for all of a month when the Branch Davidian situation took place, and this is not to exonerate Clinton or Janet Reno in this situation, the Justice Department officials in charge of the Waco situation were all elements of the networks that were involved in the Iran-Contra and Iraqgate affair, the intelligence service within an intelligence service put together by George Bush, part of the interagency governmental networks that comprise that intelligence service within an intelligence service or within a government that George Bush utilized for effecting the Iran-Contra and Iraqgate machinations. That, by the way, was George Herbert Walker Bush, the father of the current presidential Republican presidential nominee. Note the people who were in charge of the Branch Davidian situation. Note also an element that has not been focused on, which is the role of a mysterious Florida weapons dealer named Henry McMahon, who was the individual who procured the weapons for the Branch Davidians, and those weapons were the excuse for the government to move into the Branch Davidian compound. Whatever the situation with regard to that incident, it certainly has served to spark the growth of the Patriot and militia movement. Note that the martial law contingency plans developed by the recommendations or developed as an adjunct to the recommendations coming out of the Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism, that Vice President being George Bush, and another of those recommendations being to form the interagency governmental networks, some of whose members were in charge of the Branch Davidian situation. Note that the martial law contingency plans, which also grew out of the Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism, called for the deputization of paramilitary right-wingers and their use as government agents and enforcers in the event of a national emergency. Those potential enforcers and operatives' ranks were swelled greatly by the outrage, justifiable outrage, albeit propagandized outrage under the circumstances, their ranks were swelled by the Branch Davidian situation. With that introduction, whatever the actual facts concerning the Waco situation, and please note that it was the Bush networks who were in charge of this operation, although it served to besmirch Bill Clinton's administration early on, not unlike the way the Bay of Pigs served to hamstring President Kennedy's administration early on. The ultimate findings with regard to the investigation of the incineration of the Branch Davidians was greatly obfuscated by a key strategic death of someone who had been hired as a forensics expert to look into the Branch Davidian situation and analyze the forensics for the plaintiffs in a wrongful death lawsuit. Now, again, this is from the San Francisco Examiner of Monday, May 15th of the year 2000. This is in the National or Nation Dateline section of the Examiner. It's datelined, appropriately, Waco, Texas, and headlined, Waco lawsuit hobbled by expert's death. It reads in part as follows. Actually, it reads in its entirety as follows. A lawyer representing surviving Branch Davidians in a wrongful death lawsuit says the death of an infrared expert who contended that shots were fired by the government during the Waco siege is a major setback in the case. Quote, "We're not giving up, but I don't know how we'll replace Carlos Gigliotti, G-I-G-L-I-O-T-T-I, unquote, said attorney Mike Cadell, his name C-A-D-D-E-L-L. Gigliotti was hired last fall by the House Government Reform Committee to review an FBI infrared videotape taken on the final day of the Branch Davidian siege in 1993. He told the Washington Post that he had determined that repeated flashes on the video came from government gunfire. Police found Gigliotti's decomposed body at his office in Infrared Technologies Corporation in Laurel, Maryland, on April 28th, after a building manager became concerned that the analyst had not been seen for several weeks. A preliminary autopsy report showed that the 42-year-old died of a heart attack. So Carlos Gigliotti's decomposed body found at the Infrared Technologies Corporation office at which he worked, dead of an apparent heart attack at the age of 42, and his decomposed body discovered at the place that he was working. Just exactly what role his information might have played in the lawsuit and or the official governmental investigation into the Waco situation, obviously at this point, is indeterminate. I would note that death at that time. And one, of course, wonders whether that death was in fact a natural death. It's easy enough to cause what would appear to be a heart attack. The following is a very interesting story and one which remains, whose ramifications remain to be seen. This was from May 16th of the year 2000, and this is from the New York Times, and this is an article by Christopher Marcus, M-A-R-Q-U-I-S, dateline Washington, May 15th, and headlined, "The Unification Church's News Affiliate Buys United Press International." The article reads in part as follows. United Press International, the 93-year-old wire service that has struggled for years with red ink and a succession of owners, has been bought by a news affiliate of the Unification Church, company officials announced today. News World Communications Incorporated, which publishes the Washington Times and was founded by the Reverend Sun Myung Moon, the leader of the Unification Church, acquired UPI for an undisclosed sum, executives from both companies said. Skipping down, troubled by dwindling profits in recent years, UPI twice declared bankruptcy and endured a nearly continuous stream of layoffs and asset sales. The agency changed hands three times in a decade, passing from the Mexican publisher Mario Vasquez Araña to California venture capitalist Earl Bryan, and then in 1992 to its most recent owner, a company controlled by the brother-in-law of King Fahd of Saudi Arabia. Arno de Borgrav, UPI's president and chief executive officer, will remain in his current position, Mr. Moffat said. Dong Moon Ju, the president of the Washington Times Corporation, will become chairman of the UPI board of directors. I would note that Helen Thomas, viewed by many as the dean of the White House Press Corps, certainly one of the best and senior members of the White House Press Corps, resigned from UPI as a result of this particular takeover. The Moon Organization is something that we've spoken about in numerous broadcasts in the past. I would note that George Herbert Walker Bush, George Sr., was doing speeches on behalf of the Moon Organization and receiving millions of dollars in remuneration, or remuneration perhaps would be a pun under the circumstances. This in 1996 and 1997, shortly before his son's run-up to the Republican nomination. The Moon Organization has been discussed in Radio Free America program numbers 7 and 14, in addition to a miscellaneous For the Record section about broadcast about George Bush and the Moon Organization. Nominally Korean, the George Bush Organization, Freudian slip, nominally Korean, the Moon Organization actually appears to be an extension of the Japanese patriotic and ultranationalist societies that helped to bring fascism to Japan. Those organizations, sort of a combination of drug syndicates, intelligence services, and organized crime institutions, committed a series of assassinations in Japan in the 20s and 30s, and their bloodletting helped to bring fascism to Japan and to solidify its grip on that country. The peak incident was the so-called May 15th incident from May 15th in 1932, in which the Japanese prime minister and several other key figures in the Japanese government and industry were assassinated by the patriotic and ultranationalist societies. I would note that this takeover of the by the Unification Church of UPI also occurred on May 15th, sort of a second May 15th incident. The Moon Organization is nominally Korean. However, most of its early officials had been officers in the Imperial Japanese Army. Korea had been a Japanese colony up until the end of World War II. And I would note that two of the key early figures with regard to the Moon Organization were Roichi Sasakawa and Yoshio Kodama, two Japanese fascists interned by the United States as war criminals at the end of World War II. Both of them affiliated with the Asian People's Anti-Communist League and the Moon Organization, and Kodama himself very closely associated with the Japanese patriotic and ultranationalist societies. The mystery with the Moon Organization has always been where the money came from, and Daniel Junis, viewed by many as the leading authority on the Moon Organization, in an interview that I had with him in December of 1991, stated that the money appeared to come from Japanese heavy industry, the very same corporate powers that helped to bring fascism to Japan in the first place. So note the George Bush affiliation with the Moon Organization, and note that the Moon Organization has now taken control of UPI, and one of the most respected members of the White House Press Corps has resigned her position with UPI as a result of that, the aforementioned Helen Thomas. On May 29th, in For the Record program number 232, entitled Can You Picture Us in London? Or How the United Kingdom Lost the Second World War, we talked about the merging, quote, merging, unquote, of the London Stock Exchange with the Deutsche Börse, what this, quote, merger, unquote, actually was, and it is yet to be finalized by the shareholders in the London Stock Exchange. This was actually a takeover of the London Stock Exchange by the Deutsche Börse. The title comes from that famous scene in Casablanca where Humphrey Bogart, playing the Rick character, is sitting down at Rick's Cafe with some German officers, and one of them says, "Can you picture us in London?" And Humphrey Bogart says, "Ask me when you get there." Well, they have gotten there. What we're going to do first is to reprise a short section of the tail end of For the Record program number 232, ruminating about the new merged exchange's link with NASDAQ. That new merged exchange is called the IX, and we're going to listen to not only some of the musings on that by the outgoing chief of the London Stock Exchange, but also some of my musings about this, quote, merger, unquote, and then we're going to update the story. The following is from For the Record program number 232, Can You Picture Us in London? Or How the United Kingdom Lost the Second World War, recorded on May 29th of the year 2000. And we're going to conclude with a look at the proposed or possible absorption eventually of NASDAQ into this proposed IX exchange. This is from the Wall Street Journal of 5/4/2000, article by Sylvia Ascarelli, Dateline London, and headlined, New European Exchange Links with NASDAQ. And skipping down, we read, Formally, the European exchanges and NASDAQ said only that they will look into further cooperation, including cross-shareholdings. But the cooperation with NASDAQ eventually could lead to a merger of that exchange with IX, said Gavin Casey, who plans to depart as chief executive of the London Stock Exchange once the IX merger is completed. That's the end game, unquote, he said. Techies, please note. That, again, was the conclusion of For the Record program 232, Can You Picture Us in London? Or How the United Kingdom Lost the Second World War, from May 29th of the year 2000. And on top of that rumination, listen to the following from the Financial Times of Tuesday, July 18th of the year 2000. This is an article by Vincent Boland, B-O-L-A-N-D, of the Financial Times of London. It's headlined, NASDAQ explores full merger with LSE and Deutsche Börse. It reads in part as follows. NASDAQ is exploring a full merger with the London Stock Exchange and Deutsche Börse to create a global stock market spanning all the key time zones. The move announced yesterday would give NASDAQ a decisive lead over the rival New York Stock Exchange. It would combine three of the world's biggest stock markets by value, sharply intensifying the rush among the world's exchanges to cooperate. Skipping down, Werner Seifert, chief executive of Deutsche Börse, said, quote, "As a final objective, a European goal is not far-reaching enough, and that's why we are talking with NASDAQ." I would note that Werner Seifert is going to be the head of the new combined exchange, which, as we looked at in For the Record 232, is really a takeover of the London Stock Exchange, Europe's largest by volume, by the three large commercial banks that control the Deutsche Börse, that being Commerce, Dresdner, and the Deutsche Bank. Note the following comment also by Werner Seifert, this from the Wall Street Journal of that same day, Tuesday, July 18th of the year 2000, an article entitled "London and German Bourses Issue Merger Blueprint But Fail to Give Details on Pan-Europe Exchange." It's by Craig Carman in London and Marcus Walker and G. Thomas Sims in Frankfurt. And Werner Seifert's further comment on the proposed absorption of NASDAQ into the IX, quote, "Those who think only about Europe are coming up short." Intellectually, Werner Seifert, chief executive of the Deutsche Börse, said at a Frankfurt news exchange. And as the German officer said to Humphrey Bogart, and playing the Rick character in Casablanca, after asking him, "Can you picture us in London?" they said, "Can you picture us in New York?" We shall see. And again, as I intoned in For the Record program 232, techies, please take note. Note also the following. In discussions of the German corporate control over American publishing, we noted that the Holocaust apologist or Holocaust revisionist David Irving recently lost a lawsuit against Deborah Lipstadt and also against her publisher Penguin Books. And we noted that Penguin is the largest trade publisher of the Pearson Corporation. Pearson is a huge British media conglomerate, and it has two joint ventures now with Bertelsmann, one being a TV deal, the other being the Financial Times Deutschland. That sort of corporate cuddling up can enable one firm to affect the content of another. Note the following. David Irving, after that, it'll be interesting to see to what extent Bertelsmann continues to cuddle up to Pearson and what effect, if any, that has on Pearson. Do note somebody else who's been cuddling up to the Holocaust deniers, including the associates of David Irving. There was a recent Holocaust revisionist conference down at the Costa Mesa, California-based Institute for Historical Review. That's an offshoot of the Liberty Lobby, about which we've spoken many times. And there was an interesting attendee at their recent conference. The following is from the San Jose Mercury News of Tuesday, May 30th of the year 2000. This is an article by Kim Murphy of the Los Angeles Times. It's headlined, "Holocaust Doubters Gather," subtitled, "Conference, Notable Speakers at Irvine Meeting." And it was at Irvine, but it's involved, among others, David Irving. Of the aforementioned Irving, the article mentions, skipping down, "Irving's appearance was the highlight of a conference of some of the world's best-known Holocaust revisionists who met at a secret location in Irvine to promote their demands for new investigations to prove there was no mass extermination of European Jews during World War II. Joining their ranks was former Republican Representative Pete McCloskey, who was bringing a class-action lawsuit against the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, which seeks damages for the Jewish organization's alleged illegal spying on U.S. citizens critical of Israel and of the former apartheid government of South Africa. Quote, I came because I respect the thesis of this organization, unquote, McCloskey said at the gathering. Again, quoting, that thesis being that there should be a reexamination of whatever governments say, or politicians say, or political entities say, unquote. Former Representative McCloskey had a reputation as being a relatively liberal Republican, which is something of an oxymoron, perhaps. He certainly appears to be getting right back to his Republican roots by attending that kind of a conference. I would note the Republican Ethnic Outreach Conference, a direct offshoot, the Republican Ethnic Heritage Organization, I should say, a direct offshoot of the fascist organizations associated with the Third Reich. Note also the incremental legitimization of Holocaust denial and other aspects of World War II II history and other aspects of historical revisionism. And for the Record Program 197, I noted the growth in historical revisionism, not only legitimization of certain aspects of Holocaust denial or revisionism, but also Japanese historical revisionism about the massacre, the rape of Nanking, and note also revisionism by the neo-Confederate movement in the United States that associated with elements of the Fourth Reich, or what I call the Underground Reich. Those revisionist elements in the United States are attempting to justify slavery, and one is beginning to see more of that kind of thing as well. There is a fascinating detail that appeared in the New York Times of Friday, July 28th of the year 2000, updating For the Record program number 225, talking about AIDS in South Africa, that a broadcast in which we discussed, among other things, South African President Mbeki's entertaining of the hypothesis that HIV does not cause AIDS. Other people are beginning to take that aspect of historical revisionism, this other aspect of what one could call a new Holocaust denial. There's substantive evidence that AIDS was deliberately created by fascist elements within ours and the ranks, within American national security ranks and the ranks of what I call the Underground Reich, there being a considerable degree of overlap between those two. That probable creation of AIDS available in numerous broadcasts, not only for RFA Program 16, but numerous For the Record sections, and most recently in For the Record Program number 225. In tracing the heritage of the probable deliberate creation of AIDS, we noted the involvement of Peter Duisberg, one of the leading HIV revisionists, one could perhaps say, his involvement early on with Robert Gallo in the milieu that was apparently involved with the creation of AIDS. Peter Duisberg and another HIV revisionist, one could perhaps call him, David Resnick, were viewed with some favor by South African President Mbeki. I would note that Africa, and South Africa in particular, has been ravaged by AIDS. We haven't got time to discuss the obvious flaws in the HIV does not cause AIDS hypothesis. We'll get to that in more detail perhaps at some point in the future. Note somebody who was apparently more sympathetic to the HIV does not cause AIDS hypothesis than they might perhaps like to acknowledge. This from the New York Times of Friday, July 28th of the year 2000. This is entitled Lazio Linked to AIDS Dissenters. It's by Saminu Sengupta, S-E-N-G-U-P-T-A, of the New York Times, and it reads in part as follows. Attacking her opponent as, quote, out of touch with the mainstream, unquote, Hillary Rodham Clinton yesterday pointed to Representative Rick A. Lazio's link to scientists who hold that the human immunodeficiency virus does not cause AIDS. Mr. Lazio, the Republican candidate for the Senate, wrote to federal health officials earlier this year on behalf of the Group for the Scientific Reappraisal of HIV and AIDS. The group is connected to two scientists, Peter Duisberg and David Resnick, leading proponents of the view that HIV infection does not cause AIDS. On the subject of biological warfare and genetic engineering, For the Record program number 212, updating my discussion of the Nazi tract Serpent's Walk, published in softcover by National Vanguard Books, copyright 1991, and authored by someone who writes under the name of Randolph D. Calverhall, we spoke about one of the elements in the Nazi takeover that is outlined in that particular book. As I've mentioned, like the Turner Diaries, also published by National Vanguard Books, I believe that Serpent's Walk is not actually the novel it purports to be, but rather a blueprint, a manifesto for what Nazi elements around the world are in fact engaged in. The Nazi takeover in Serpent's Walk takes place after genetically engineered microorganisms of apparently Soviet origin are disseminated around the world and wipe out much of the U.S. population, including the President and Vice President of the United States. The Speaker of the House then takes over and invites the Nazis in as a ruling coalition in the mid-21st century. Note the following. Research credit on this goes to a member of the listening audience. This comes from Alexander Coburn and Jeffrey St. Clair's Counterpunch newsletter, issue of June 1st and 15th of the year 2000. It's headlined, New Bio War on Drugs, subtitled McCaffrey's Plagues, and it reads in part as follows. along with the other enormities presently perpetrated in the name of the war on drugs, the United States is now actively preparing to deploy biological weapons. The weapons consist of plant pathogens designed to attack coca, cannabis, and opium poppy crops. Research into the project has involved the resurrection of biological agents developed long ago at Fort Detrick, Maryland's Center for the U.S. Biowar Program, closed down by President Nixon in 1969. Deep frozen at the time of the program's termination, they are now being thawed out and readied for assault on producer countries in the Third World. Also involved are veterans of the Soviet biological warfare effort, now being funded by the U.S. through the connivance of an obscure U.N. agency employed for this purpose in order to shield the U.S. from well-deserved charges of violating the internationally negotiated Biological Weapons Convention. The work is proceeding despite well-attested evidence that the weapons, if deployed, will have profound and disastrous impact on the ecologies of the countries in which they are used. Furthermore, the USDA is now researching the use of genetic modification to enhance the potency of these bioweapons. The principal agents under development are microbial pathogens. At the Institute for Genetics in Kazakhstan, former Soviet bio-warriors are being financed by the U.S. and Britain to test mycoherbicides, fungi, specifically Pleospora, to kill opium poppies and marijuana plants. In the Andes and western Amazon, the U.S. is planning the testing and widespread application of Fusarium oxysporium, an anti-coca fungus. Skipping down, speaking of one of the agents that is going to be utilized in this particular program, according to Coburn and St. Clair, a bio agent known as D437, we read, skipping down, following Nixon's order to close the place down, that being Fort Detrick, D-437 was not destroyed but put in deep frozen storage, forgotten by all but the researchers who had worked so happily at Detrick. On April 12th of this year, Hammond caught a brief mention of D-437 on a U.S. Army website, along with the fact that it was being studied by a Dr. Vernon Domsteegt, D-A-M-S-T-E-E-G-T, I'm not sure how that's pronounced, himself, a Detrick veteran. I would note that Fort Detrick turned over to the National Cancer Institute, but maintained for it by Litton Bionetics, was the epicenter for the National Cancer Institute's special viral cancer research project, which appears to have been the germ for the development of AIDS, pun intended, under the circumstances. Whether or not some unintended effect of the use of Fort Detrick results from this remains to be seen. I would note in quoting from Serpent's Walk that the genetically engineered viruses that attack the United States infiltrate into the United States through the drug routes, and that is described in Serpent's Walk as follows. Who was spreading the toxins? The carriers were entering the United States along the drug routes, Miami and the Gulf Coast, the Canadian border, and the deserts of the Southwest. Morgan, one of the Nazi faithful, who served as the American representative for one of the movement's conglomerates, had heard that most of these people were a motley assortment, druggies with habits so heavy they would risk anything for a pop of smile dust, the usual dispossessed Palestinians and Iranians, criminals, psychopaths, and madmen whose hatred and greed outweighed their instinct for self-preservation, and mercs willing to escalate war beyond any civilized limit. No genuine Russians had been caught thus far. One wonders whether any Russians will be caught. One wonders whether perhaps there might be some intentional or unintentional side effect, so to speak, of this particular genetically engineered aspect of the war on drugs. Do note the Serpent's Walk scenario. That concludes For the Record, Program 243. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.